You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 18th of February 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, the voice of Islamic State's propaganda videos belongs to a Canadian. Now in prison in northern Syria, we'll find out more about Mohammed Khalifa and the effect the films he voices had on recruiting followers. Also ahead, seven members of the British opposition resign after claims the Labour Party's anti-Semitic and over its position on Brexit. We'll ask if it'll make any difference or just add to the chaos. Plus,
essentially, the president said he did not believe that the North Koreans had the capability to hit us here with ballistic missiles in the United States. And he did not believe that because President Putin had told him they did not.
The former acting head of the FBI becomes the latest high-ranking US official to spill the beans on life under Donald Trump's authority. We'll also ask if forcing Italians to listen to more of their own music will make it any less awful, and we'll go through the newspapers in the US. That's all ahead on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And a very warm welcome to Studio One. His voice has been described as the most recognisable English-speaking voice to have ever appeared in Islamic State's propaganda. But only now has the identity of the man who narrated dozens of IS videos and radio recordings been made public. He is Mohammed Khalifa, who's a 35-year-old Canadian national. He studied in Toronto, but he's now being held in prison in northern Syria. Well, someone who's met him and interviewed him is Rukmini Kalamaki. She's a correspondent for the New York Times covering the Islamic State, and she left Syria this morning. I'm delighted to say she's taken the time to talk to us on Monocle 24. Thank you so much, Rukmini. Tell us, who is Mohammed Khalifa?
Mohammed Khalifa is a 35-year-old man, originally born in Saudi Arabia, but grew up in the Toronto area of Canada. In many ways, his life in Canada was unremarkable. He went to a place called Seneca College. He then worked as a computer technician at a number of IBM contracting companies. But inside the Islamic State, he was... I think it's fair to say that he was perhaps the most notorious narrator of the terror group. He appears in countless videos and in countless radio bulletins that ISIS put out. He was never named, so it was always just a voiceover, a voice that you heard narrating these incredibly brutal scenes of executions. And we were able to finally identify him, and I was the first reporter to be able to interview him in Syria recently.
What was it like meeting him, having heard his voice connected with such savagery up until that point?
You know, what was stunning is of course, in the videos, he's very defiant. There's a lot of braggadocio. He's always talking about how the Islamic State is never going to cede. The Islamic State is never going to be cowed. So you imagine that the person is going to be this sort of, you know, larger than life, big person. And what was stunning is when they brought him into the room where I was going to speak to him in handcuffs, and the very first thing that you notice is how small he is. He's a very thin and diminutive man. And when he sat in front of me, he has a kind of sheepish grin. When he answers questions, he sometimes giggles, and he's almost effeminate. I don't know how else to say it, but it was a very different look than what I imagined him to be. At the same time, what was interesting about him is that he expresses no regret. He was very clear on that. I asked him, "Do you look at you? You are now, you know, essentially in chains. You're imprisoned. You're in limbo legally because Canada is not taking back these prisoners right now. And in Syria, he's in a crowded jail cell." And he said quite clearly, "No, I have no regrets. I have told that to my interrogators, both the first one and the second one, and I'm now telling that to you. I do not regret what I did."
And how did you react to that?
You know, it's funny to say this, but I've done a good number of interviews with ISIS prisoners by now, several dozen. And Oftentimes, when people are in prison, especially in Iraq and Syria, where conditions can be tough, and especially in Iraq, where they're often facing the death penalty, you will see them do a 180. But you understand in the interview that it's most likely not sincere. But they will say to you, this is not the real Islam. I was duped. I was manipulated. I made a mistake. And you understand at some level that they're saying that out of fear. So at some level, I hope this doesn't sound weird or strange, but I almost respect him for standing by his beliefs. This is a man who has now spent more than 6.5 years inside this battle zone. He very much believed in this ideology, which of course the rest of the world considers hideous and brutal and grotesque. But he's at least willing to own it and say, no, I stand by this and I do not regret what I've done.
Is it that surprising, though, given the amount of influence that what his words had over countless young Americans, Canadians, Brits, Australians, effectively anybody from the English-speaking world who got access to these videos?
That's true. I mean, it would be quite cowardly for him at this point in time, having influenced so many others, to then suddenly, you know, do a 180 and say, no, I don't believe in this anymore.
One thing that we've noticed in the past few days is we've had the final battle to remove the caliphate from Syria. And little by little, former IS members or people who say that they willingly went but unwillingly realised what life was like when they were under IS, they're all trying to come back. We've had the case of Hoda Mathana saying that she's so sorry for what she did. We have a British teenager in a Syrian refugee camp at the moment who has just given birth and yet refused to publicly apologise for the fact that she became a poster girl for Islamic State. Right. Is there still that feeling that there is an influence that IS can have, despite the fact that its territory is going?
You know, so I just left Syria this morning, and I was there for exactly 3 weeks, for 21 days. We were there waiting for the last village under ISIS control in the region where their caliphate was born to fall. When I got there, the area under their control was no larger than Central Park in New York City. It was a very small three square kilometer area. And for 21 days, we've been waiting for that area to fall, and it still hasn't fallen. As of this morning, ISIS is still holding on. And so you're seeing people come out, thousands of people that are coming out. I went out into the desert and waited and interviewed a good number of them as they were coming. And there was a minority of people who said that they regretted what they had done. Hoda Mathana, who I've also interviewed, was one of them. But the more common refrain is what we heard from the Bethnal Green young woman who has just, as you said, given birth, where they continue to hold on to these beliefs. And that shouldn't be surprising in a way, because these are the most hardcore devotees of this group. These are the people that survived in the caliphate for more than 4 years, and they essentially moved alongside the shrinking shadow of the caliphate. They tell you that they were in Raqqa. When Raqqa was lost, they moved to Mayadeen. When Mayadeen was lost, they moved to Abu Kamal. When Abu Kamal was lost, they moved to Shafa and Hajin, and then finally to this little village called Baghouz. And so they basically stayed there up until the very end. And so we shouldn't be surprised that the ones coming out now are people that have, you know, a true dedication to this movement. Now, I wanted to correct one thing. What is being widely reported is that this is the end of the caliphate. It is definitely the end of the caliphate in the region where it was born, in Iraq and Syria. But the caliphate was never just a regional project. When it was announced in 2014, it was always a global experiment. And at the one-year anniversary of this terrorist entity, ISIS announced that almost half of their provinces were outside of Iraq and Syria. And what is interesting is that even as they're losing territory here, their prowess and their footprint elsewhere, in countries like Nigeria, in countries like the Philippines, in Afghanistan, is growing.
We've heard in the news this week that Donald Trump wants the countries of origin of the IS fighters or IS members to take them back, otherwise he will allow them to be released anywhere they wish. Canada is saying that it's reluctant to take back the likes of Mohammed Khalifa. There's an enormous amount of debate taking place in the United Kingdom now about what to do with Shamima Begum. Her lawyer says that she is experiencing the equivalent of World War I shell shock. So profoundly traumatised is she by what she has witnessed and taken part in. What's the general feeling where you are among the authorities, or where you have been, to decide what needs to be done with these people?
I can tell you that among Syrians and among the Kurds who have been the most loyal allies of the American-backed coalition in fighting ISIS in Syria, there's a level of disgust towards these people. These are people who came from overseas, who destroyed their country, who helped destroy their country, and they're a little bit perplexed at the amount of sympathy that they're getting from some corners of the West. The notion that this young woman was only 15, you know, when she went over there, that therefore she must have been brainwashed, manipulated. Look, all of those things possibly played a role, but this was also a person who became a woman inside the caliphate, and who, as far as we know, did not try to escape until the very last sliver of the caliphate in Syria was about to disappear, and only then turned herself in.
Rukmini Kelemaki, correspondent for the New York Times covering IS. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line. You're listening to Monocle 24. It's 22:11 here in London, and this is the Monocle Daily Live from Studio One at Midori House. Now, they don't have a name, a party, any great deal of money, or indeed a manifesto. But today, seven members of the British opposition Labour Party resigned and formed their own group. They will now be called the Independent Group. And their reasons for leaving Labour were different. They freely admitted the diversity of their ages, their backgrounds and their political positions. But the message was clear. Labour doesn't stand for its members anymore. And if you're a politician from any party and you feel the same, come and join us. But will this moment in the headlines make any difference, not just to Labour, but to British politics in general? Well, one man who might be able to help us is Lance Price. He was Tony Blair's Director of Communications, and he joined us once again on Monocle 24. Welcome back, Lance. Just describe to us how you would describe the Independent Group.
They are a group of moderate former Labour MPs who have decided, after agonising about it for a very long time and talking about it amongst themselves and with others for a very long time, to resign from the Labour Party and set up their own group within the House of Commons. Now, nobody thinks that this is the end of the story. They clearly are hoping that others will join them. And I've no doubt at all that dozens of other Labour MPs have been agonising about whether they should have been with them, whether in their hearts they are with them, even if their minds tell them that they need to stay with the Labour Party for the time being. And there's a good chance that it will morph into a political party in name as well as in fact sooner rather than later. I think they're sensibly not donning sort of Superman outfits and Superwoman outfits and claiming that they have all the answers and a name of a party and all the rest of it, because I think that kind of politics probably has had its day. They're going to wait and see who comes in to support them, what kind of grassroots support they get, both from former members of the Labour Party and from people who feel alienated by politics altogether at the moment.
It was interesting when the announcement was made that seven people, about three or four were pretty recognisable, the others you had to sort of look up, walked into the room, and they had been billing this as a great change in the development of British politics. And someone said on social media a little while ago, this has been a long time coming. The press conference we've just seen, they verbalise what so many of us have been feeling for months and years. There has been an enormous groundswell, hasn't there, for some sort of alternative voice to produce itself in the mess that is British politics at the moment.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the main reasons for that is that there's a vacuum. The extremist Brexit, English nationalist wing of the Conservative Party, the tail is sort of wagging the Conservative Party dog. They are beholden, Theresa May is beholden to her right wing. The Labour Party clearly has gone way off to the left, and many moderates and centre-left people think there's not much hope of dragging it back towards the centre. The Liberal Democrats, traditionally the centre party, have totally failed to capitalise on that situation. So there is a vacuum at the heart of British politics, and politics, like nature, abhors a vacuum. Something had to fill it, and we're starting to see that space being filled. And if the demand is as great as I think it is, then that body in the centre is going to grow.
How successful do you believe it to be? Because a lot of people have said this is fine for today. It will cause short-term harm to the Labour Party, but it might actually just fizzle like most of these breakaway parties ultimately do.
It might fizzle. There haven't been that many breakaway parties because the system discriminates against any kind of breakaway and any kind of small party in the centre. The first-past-the-post system normally makes, when general elections or by-elections come along, forces us all to choose the least of two evils if we're not wildly enthusiastic about either of the big parties. So the system does make life very difficult for people who splinter away from parties. It could come to nothing. I think that's unlikely. I think a lot will depend on what happens over the next few weeks. We're going to find out more very, very quickly. And the way in which Jeremy Corbyn and the leadership of the Labour Party respond to what's happened today will be absolutely crucial. And if people who have sympathies with the seven who've left today see no movement at all, for example, towards a people's vote, which we know a large majority of Labour Party members would like to see happen over Brexit, if there's no movement, if Jeremy Corbyn and the people around him continue to denigrate those who have views like the seven who've left today, then I think that will only encourage more to go the same way.
I don't know if you heard the news about this, the BBC accidentally broadcasting the comments of someone who's watching the announcement being made, and I'll paraphrase it. So someone accidentally was heard on air saying, "Between this and Brexit, we are actually effed," said the man in a live broadcast. "It's going to be so divided, the Conservatives are going to win, it's mad, mad." That person has a point, don't they?
Well, they have a point about if you divide the centre-left votes, then the chances are that the people who benefit most from that are the right. So if you split the Labour Party, basically the only winners are the Conservatives. Now, there is some truth in that. We've yet to see, of course, whether or not a similar splintering could happen in the Conservative Party. That is perfectly possible. And some very senior and thoughtful Conservative commentators and former MPs have been predicting a split in the Conservative Party for some time. So it could be that this is the first splinter in a fracturing of the whole political system of both big parties. And Brexit is such a big issue for the body politic in the United Kingdom, for all of us who live in the United Kingdom, that it's big enough. It's the one thing that is big enough to break apart that consensus which has held the two parties together. Two parties which have been coalitions of people who fundamentally disagree about all sorts of things, but they still sit in the same party. And what the people who've left today are saying is, actually, we don't have to do it that way anymore.
It's funny you talk about the idea of different parties living under one roof, because the reputation that the Blair years has was of a time of, what people have said, is a time of total control. Do you think that people are still trying to work their way through that?
Well, it was a time. We were described as control freaks, and we were control freaks, and we sought to exercise control over the party, and that we were trying to change the whole ethos of the party, which worked for a while, clearly didn't work long term. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in now. But during that period, the left were happily still within the Labour Party. They weren't being disciplined. Jeremy Corbyn was an MP. He was rebelling against the leadership of the Labour Party time and time and time and time again. The Labour Party only works and is only credible as an alternative government when it can hold all those people together and have the kind of policies and the kind of leadership which is not only acceptable to the broad church of people who support centre-left politics, but also can convince the electorate that they have the kind of programme that they're willing to support. Now, that patently isn't the case anymore.
I imagine that Tony Blair might be quite happy about what's been announced today. Do you think he's had any involvement in this?
I don't think he's happy at all. I don't think anybody in the Labour Party is happy to see the pass that we've come to and the situation that we're in. It's not what any Labour person once. Now, has Tony Blair been involved in discussions with others, including perhaps some of those who left today, about the direction of British politics? Almost certainly, yes, he has, and people around him have as well. I think he's very wisely keeping out of the debate for today and for the time being. He's not necessarily the best recruiting sergeant for a new movement. And I think it's very important, actually. People have been looking back a lot. They've been looking back to what happened when the Social Democrats left the Labour Party back in the 1980s. I mean, a generation ago, they look back to the Blair years. They look back to the history of divisions in the Labour Party. I think what this movement should be doing, if it's going to have any chance of success at all, is looking forwards to the new kind of politics that people, I think, are crying out for, a lot of young people are crying out for. And that isn't about top-down leadership.
Lance Price, thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Daily. Up next, we ask if the former acting FBI director Andrew McCabe's latest comments about Trump and Putin are more than publicity for his new book. Stay with us.
California, here we come. Monocle has arrived on the West Coast. Our new shop and bureau is open at Platform, the design quarter in Culver City, that's home to 100 boutique retail and culinary brands. If you're in town, pop along to meet the team, pick up the latest issue of the magazine and browse our exclusive collaborations. From elegant stationery to smart jackets, plus plenty in the way of print, of course. Discover our range from furniture to fragrances, courtesy of brands from the US and beyond. Intrigued? Then come and see us at our new LA outpost at Platform in Culver City. We look forward to meeting you there.
And you're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. The former acting director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, says he was fired because he opened a counter-investigation into President Donald Trump. Mr. McCabe gave an interview to CBS's 60 Minutes this weekend in which he described how Donald Trump trusted Vladimir Putin above his own intelligence teams. Well, Charles Hecker is a senior partner at Control Risks. He looks like the kind of group that I think President Trump could probably do with at the moment. Charles, a very warm welcome back to the studio. Right, let's get this out in the open. Mr. McCabe has a book to flog. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's not making quite an interesting point here.
That's right. These two things can travel on separate tracks, but it is essentially the oldest trick in the book to drop a major bomb when you've just published a tome that is meant to sort of be juicy and that you want to see rocket to the top of the bestseller list, which, by the way, is something that's happening with just about everybody who's left or been fired from the Trump administration.
Of which there are quite a few now. And I did want to ask you, the fact is that these books are coming out quite a lot now, and an awful lot is being said, not necessarily surprising, not necessarily unexpected, but all of it a surprise. But it doesn't seem to have done anything to Donald Trump.
That's right. You know, you can publish as many books as you like, apparently, and the guy is just absolutely unrockable. And I suppose that's because he's working very, very hard, and he's been pushing the Twitter button hard and fast over the past few days. He's doing everything he can to undermine every one of these books, including the McCabe book just out, as they're published. And we all know that there's this rock-solid group of supporters that, short of burning down the White House, will never believe anything bad said against him.
So what is the bomb that Andrew McCabe has dropped? I alluded that the trust for Putin was higher than for the for his own intelligence services, but he sort of digs around quite well, doesn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah. So what McCabe tells 60 Minutes, American television news magazine, is that according to somebody who was sitting in the room at the time, who wasn't McCabe, but was somebody else who goes to White House intelligence briefings, that the president was receiving a briefing on the nuclear capabilities of North Korea and was presented with a series of important intelligence findings that were meant to show the president that North Korea is a serious nuclear military threat that the United States has absolutely got to come to grips with. And the president said, "I don't care what you say, I believe Putin." And, you know, how many different ways is this wrong for a president of the United States to say? It wasn't a publicly made remark, but it was a remark made in the Oval Office of the White House, at the nucleus, if you will, of the American presidency. And he's saying, I don't really care what all of you people who spend your careers and your lives working on and sacrificing yourselves for. I believe the president of a country who is an antagonist to my country. You know, the President Putin is a rival to American security. And the president of the United States says he takes the president of Russia's word for it over his own intelligence agencies.
It is not an enormous jump, though, to think that actually if you are Donald Trump, you don't understand any of the people around you because you've never had to deal with them. But the people who you do understand are people who are your mirror. And arguably, we're not a million miles off when we have the president of Russia.
Did you see there was this enormous beaming grin on President Trump's face when President Putin arrived at, gosh, I can't remember exactly what the meeting was, but they're all lined up there, and there's Angela Merkel, and there's Shinzo Abe, and they're all the leaders of the world, and Trump is there, and Putin walks into the room, and Trump breaks out into this ear-to-ear grin, and you just know that he's thinking to himself, wow, I'm hanging out with Vladimir Putin. I'm hanging out with the big guys. And of course he wants to listen to what they say. And of course he wants to believe them because he's one of them now. He's at the table with these guys. And President Trump, we know, has been placing a lot of emphasis in geopolitics on individual relationships. He said this over and over again. I have a good relationship with Vladimir Putin. I have a good relationship with Xi Jinping. I have a good relationship with President Erdogan of Turkey. And this personalization of politics is one of the calling cards of his presidency.
Right. So in the light of McCabe's allegations, where does this leave Donald Trump and the security of his position?
Yeah, so it must be alarming to him to think that there were people in the FBI who were seeking to build a coalition, if you will, or to build momentum around his ouster. That McCabe and Rod Rosenstein were thinking about building a community support about invoking the 25th Amendment of the Constitution, which is to say that the president is mentally incapacitated and no longer fit for office. And that appears to be what was brewing in the FBI. I mean, and there's two ways of looking at this. You can say that, look, these are career law enforcement individuals working under daily public scrutiny, and they wouldn't have done this unless they felt that there was something serious going on here and unless the costs they thought were high enough. On the other hand, this has played directly into the president's hands about thinking that there's some sort of deep state that's out to get him. And I guess finally, it goes to show just how deeply politicized everything is and how weaponized all of our processes are in the United States now, that you've got people inside the FBI, inside the nation's premier law enforcement agency, thinking, we've got to push this guy out of office.
And Mueller's investigation, how does this alter things?
Mueller's investigation is one of the most rigidly conducted and sort of irreproachably managed investigations. And I guess you could see all of this as a bit of a sideshow to the Mueller investigation, from which there have been no leaks, from which there have been nothing but successful prosecutions and more than a dozen of them, some of them ending in felony jail sentences. This is probably an unfortunate sideshow, and it's probably going to provide some ammunition to President Trump to say, well, Mueller is of the same ilk as McCabe and as Rosenstein, and he's coming out of this FBI that's out to get me, and he will probably use all of this to delegitimize the Mueller investigation.
Charles Hacker, thank you very much indeed. Still to come on the Monocle Daily, we hear from the editor of Vanity Fair Italy. We'll look at the evening newspapers in the US too. But first, with the time at 22:28 here in London, here's a summary of the latest world news headlines. Yemen's warring parties have agreed to start withdrawing forces from the main port of Hodeidah under a UN-sponsored deal. The city's been in Houthi hands since 2014. The UN's hoping that the de-escalation in Hodeidah will allow food and medical supplies to reach millions of people in need. Saudi Arabia has pledged investment deals worth $20 billion with Pakistan, which is seeking to bolster its fragile economy. The agreements include plans to build an oil refinery and petrochemical complex in the southern port of Gwadar. The deals come as part of a high-profile Asian tour by the Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. 7 Labour politicians have quit Britain's main opposition party over their leader Jeremy Corbyn's approach to Brexit and claims of anti-Semitism. They'll now sit in Parliament as an independent group of members. The announcement constitutes the first major split of the Labour Party in 4 decades. And a summit of Central European leaders in Israel has been cancelled because of a row between Israel and Poland. The Polish delegation pulled out of a planned trip to the Visegrad summit in Jerusalem after Israel's foreign minister accused Poles of hatred against Jews and complicity in the Holocaust. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. Still to come on today's programme, we look at the US newspaper headlines. Well, a little bit later we'll be asking whether playing more Italian music will make Italians fall more in love with their own music. But first, we stay in Italy because the Italian version of Vanity Fair is the first non-English language edition. And it's also the first weekly version of the legendary title. It was launched in 2003 and the magazine has recently had a refresh, thanks to a new editor, Simone Marchetti, who's a former fashion editor for La Repubblica. On Monocle's Fernanda Augusto Pacheco heard from Simone and got a bit overexcited about the new issue that's out now, featuring the Italian legend Raffaella Carrà on the cover.
I choose to put on the cover a very famous Italian icon from the Italian television, one of the most important, the most recognizable, and she's Raffaella Carrà. She started doing television in the 60s, and she is pioneer. A feminist, not only a soubrette, a singer or an actress, but she really made the revolution before the revolution, before the 69, with her lightness. But in my opinion, that lightness was more profound than anything else. So I decided to put her on the cover in a very unexpected way. I think that I have to present the known in an unexpected way. So I put on her a very iconic dress from Valentino, from Pierpaolo Piccioli. And it's the opposite. It's the pop and the couture. It's the fashion and the television, something that were not related. And I think that nowadays you have to bring back beautiness into pop culture. That's the key factor. At the same time, you have to put tradition, the highest tradition, without any stereotypes, without any limits, into the nowadays media that are, which are very, very different from the past.
You know, Simone, with that cover, is it you trying to say that, you know, Vanity Fair, yes, you will be high fashion as well and couture, but you also, you will talk about, you know, Italian pop culture as well, you know, because the magazine has been through a little redesign, I believe. Is that what you want as well, to make it pop?
I think that I remember when I was talking to Miuccia Prada some years ago, and she was saying something very smart that made me think a lot. She was saying it's too easy to speak to a niche, to a little niche. It's very easy. And I can do fashion for a very little niche of the market and doing something very special, very sophisticated. But at the end, I'm talking to a small audience. And she was saying, with my brand Prada, I want to talk to a lot of people. So I have to bring art, sophistication, and beautiness into pop. That's the risky and the strong thing to do today. And I think that I would like to do the same thing with the magazine. So pop is not a diminution of something. It's just a way to bring beauty, stories, intelligence, entertainment, philosophy too, because there will be philosophy and poems in the magazine too, to a large audience. I think that nowadays it's very important to treat the pop culture in this way.
Well, and that issue is fantastic. And it's very, you know, it's quite a full magazine. It's 300 pages as well.
Which is very rare today. I mean, it's not that common to have 300 pages. It's a huge success and a good indicator, I think.
It's a good indicator that people still want to read like a nice printed product as well, right?
Yes, from the very beginning, I didn't want to do a magazine. I always say I like to build a network. I think that everyone is talking about the end of the printed press. I think that nowadays we need the press, generally speaking, more than ever, because of all that we are looking at, starting from populism and to the problem of democracy. I think that the journalistic point of view is relevant, and it is still relevant, and it's very necessary. But you don't have to think only like a magazine or a website or Instagram pages. You have to think organically. So my new Vanity Fair, just to make short, long story, it's like an opera in three acts. The first act is very virtual. So with all the talented artists that we are hosting on our cover, we do an artistic project, not only a beautiful picture. So we sat down with Raffaella Carrà, and we will sit down with a lot of other artists, and we start to think about what's going on in the world, what's your aesthetic, what you want to say, what I want to say. And then we realize short movies or something very special for Instagram and our website. So in the very beginning of the week, the news starts to spread out all around and become an argument of discussion. So on Wednesday, when the magazine came out in the newsstands, this is the second act, the magazine goes back to the old era of the magazine. So it's very rich, graphically speaking. It's not like internet or Instagram. It's the opposite. It's very artisanal. It's very curated. It's very deep, but with a simple, simple language. Then the last act in the weekend, we ask to the talents and to the artists that we are hosting on the cover to meet their public and our audience in the theater that we are building inside Condé Nast Italy, in the center of Milano. So we are building a kind of very real theater where they can do performances for us and meet the public, I think, and our audience. I think that nowadays experience, it's a key factor. So this is why I'm talking about a network. And in the second phase, we are doing a lot of exhibition, collaboration with Italian televisions, and so on. Again, it's a network. And I think that the editorial business has to rethink itself, but at the same time, has to be itself more than ever.
The editor of Italian Vanity Fair, Simone Marchetti, talking to Monocle's Fernanda Augusta Pacheco. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And if you've just joined us, a very warm welcome to Studio One. It's Emma Nelson here with the Monocle Daily live on Monocle 24. In a moment, we head to the United States to get the latest front pages of the US pages. But first, the career of the architect and urban designer Sir Terry Farrell has spanned six decades, and it includes the likes of the MI6 headquarters to the Guangzhou railway station in China. Well, Monocle's Josh Fennett sat down with a postmodern master recently here at Midori House.
I got the impression that it's a fairly well-worn path. I was very keen on drawing and painting, and I used to paint landscapes and so on. And I was ill at home, and my mother was fed up because one of her boys, I was one of four boys, was at home. And she had persuaded me, or tried to persuade me, to go to apply to the civil service like her father.
A sensible job with a pension and a career progression.
Yes. And she argued with me that I could paint in the evenings and draw. And then I started drawing because I was invalid and at home. I started drawing the house opposite. And she said, why don't you be an architect? And I looked at up what an architect was. And I went to work. My art teacher organized for me to go to work in an architect's office that summer. And I was hooked.
So of those two places, Manchester and Newcastle, they have a very particular vernacular, a particular look. Is that something that you kind of imbibed when you were younger, that you took in from around you, these industrial cities, these beautiful structures? Or is it something you reacted against, do you think?
No, I loved at the time Manchester, which I don't remember very much about because I was 8 when I left there. I grew up in Newcastle. I identify with Newcastle, and that's an extraordinary city.
And you obviously, which we'll talk about a little later, went on to do a lot of work in Newcastle, but yes, from master planning to the beautiful Life Centre there. But what I'd like to talk to you about is education and where education and architecture cross over. You were lucky enough to have a kind of lightning bolt of inspiration that it was a career path that you wanted to follow. But do you think enough children are encouraged to think about the built environment or to make the leap from painting to architecture, as you did?
And particularly in the what you might call the working classes and the lower middle class. It's a posh profession, is architecture. You need a moneyed client, and you tend to be old during your life, not doing the ordinary. And I think my requesting the archive to Newcastle University, which I'm doing, will be an incentive for boys and girls, people like me, that will come from that kind of background.
So do you think we need to encourage a wider range of voices to talk about the city and to talk about architecture? You mentioned different classes, but I suppose different ethnic minorities and the imbalance of, I suppose, women who are architects as well. Do we all need to talk and have these urgent conversations about the city?
We need to have people involved in the environment, environment making and city making, who are from the broadest spectrum of the population, because the architects are just a fraction. They do just a fraction of what's needed and what's and city making is about. They do a small posh spectrum.
I tend to agree with you. I'm going to ask you to fast forward. We've spoken a little bit about your childhood, but when you graduated, you took a bit of a plunge, a rather brave one, to work for yourself, not to go and work in the office of a well-known architecture practice, but to seek commissions on your own and do things under your own steam. If you could go back to that time now, what would you tell yourself? What advice would you give to you?
I have no idea, really, about what I would do right now. But I did then, in the 60s, just after I'd finished college, I was invited by a middle-class, well-heeled person that I'd befriended, Nick Grimshaw, to undertake a project for his uncle. And I set up from that point. And I only lasted 6 months working for someone else.
I feel like you're being very modest and putting it down to the luck of the commissioning, but it must have taken some drive, I suppose, and some grit to think to yourself, well, actually, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this on my own. I have a strong enough opinion about what I do and a faith in my ability to, you know, to run your own practice.
Well, I'm unusual. I'm the only one of my generation that earned his keep as he went. I relied upon designing an architecture as my sole source of income. And I have 5 children, and I moved homes, and I had the children all had comfortable homes and so on. And I earned it from architecture, which is unusual.
And is there any advice? We live in a world where the notion of entrepreneurship is kind of fetishized to some extent. Everyone has a project that they're working on, an idea that they'd like to bring to fruition. But what advice would you give after all the years that you've, as you say, run your own business, to people that are starting out today? Or is the landscape so different?
I think the mold needs to be broken. It's got to be rewarding and financially have some incentive to work for other than libraries and art galleries or property developers. It's got to be, the mold has got to be broken so that people are working where they're needed in this field. If you look around you, the streets and the houses and the hospitals are solely in need of design and dedication of professionals that, whatever they are, you know, whether they're in surveying or landscaping or architecture or planning or engineering, they need to go about making the ordinary, the everyday.
The brilliant British architect Sir Terry Farrell there, speaking to Josh Fennett in a special edition of our design podcast, Monocle on Design, dedicated to that extended interview. You can catch the full interview at 1900 London time tomorrow or download the podcast whenever you like. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. The time is 22:46 here in London. Let's find out what's making the front pages in the United States. I'm joined today by Monocle correspondent Henry Rees Sheridan, who's in New York. Welcome, Henry. What's making the headlines?
Thanks for having me, Emma. I want to begin today with the story which is on the front page of the New York Times. The headline, "It's not a closet, it's a cage. Gay Catholic priests speak out." Now, obviously, sexuality within the Catholic Church is under a great deal of scrutiny at the moment following ongoing revelations about the sexual abuse of young boys and more recently the revelations that is nuns within the church. And in the midst of this, the Times has published a really sensitive and searching report on gay priests within the church from Elizabeth Diaz, who covers faith issues for the Times. It's based on interviews with about two dozen gay priests and seminarians. It really illustrates what it's like to be gay within the church in 2019. The report sets out the contradiction that the church puts these men in. In Diaz's words, church leaders have driven gay congregants away in shame for years and insisted homosexual tendencies are disordered, and yet thousands of the church's priests are gay. And one of the most interesting takeaways of the report for me are the numbers that they estimate gay men comprise within the church. They apparently probably make up at least 30 to 40% of the American Catholic clergy, which is far higher than the proportion within the non-Catholic church population. And it illustrates as well some of the stakes that these men face when it comes to coming out. In the USA, the church almost always controls a priest's housing, health insurance, and also retirement pension. Now, if a priest's bishop sees his sexuality as disqualifying him from his office, then he could lose all three of these tenets of his life. So a really kind of, I think, urgent but also thoughtful report.
It's astonishing. It's a very deep read. It has a very profound effect on anybody who's never heard these kind of voices before. And it's no great surprise because everybody who has spoken to the New York Times, or most of them, have done it under the guarantee of anonymity. And still, people say that were they to speak out and were people to know that they were gay, then that would be the end of their lives.
I think one of the most tragic aspects of the report for me is it points out that there's been a homophobic backlash within the church to the horrible revelations about sexual abuse of boys within the church. Now, it's important to put front and centre that studies have repeatedly found that there is no connection between being gay and abusing children. But there's lots of right-wingers within the Catholic Church who have singled out gay priests and scapegoated them as the root of that particular problem. And one of the reasons that this report is so timely is that this week, Pope Francis is looking to host a summit on sex abuse with bishops from around the world. And the report says that the debate promises to be not only about holding bishops accountable, but also on the broader issue of homosexuality and the church's position on it itself. So we'll be hearing perhaps some striking statements from the Pope this Thursday, I believe, the summit begins.
Let's move on to the Wall Street Journal, an excellent article about the divided America display this weekend in Munich at this security conference, which was astonishing given the fact that I think Mike Pence wanted everybody to give a great round of applause to Donald Trump, and it was not forthcoming from the Germans. And it showed effectively how deep the divide was between Germany and the European Union and America is in terms of defence policy, but also exposed a huge divide between the Republicans and Democrats.
Right, so the Wall Street Journal paints this picture of a kind of Janus-faced US presence at the Munich Security Conference. As you mentioned, Mike Pence was one of the big representatives there. And he put forward this image of a kind of transatlantic alliance drawn along new lines, lines in which America was going to be a bit more strident in pursuing its interests. He cited his US achievements, the fact that the US has tried to at least push NATO members to pay their dues, a long-standing gripe for the US. Also, the US's opposition to Germany's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project, which has proven to be controversial because it stands to benefit Russia. Now, in contrast to Pence, a few hours later, the former Vice President Joe Biden stepped up to the lectern and presented a more conventional, and to the Europeans at least, more agreeable version of the pre-Trumpian transatlantic relationship. He actually said, "This too shall pass. We will be back. Don't have any doubt about that," which kind of, you know, gives you an idea of what the Europeans want to hear. They want the idea that, you know, that the relationship is going to return to what they regard as normal.
And finally, and very briefly, if you wouldn't mind, President Trump thinks he's getting the Nobel Prize, and Shinzo Abe has something to say about it.
Yeah, it's well, he kind of has nothing to say about it. It's kind of this is a weird story. Basically, on Friday, Trump suggested that Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, has nominated him for the Nobel Prize. Abe has not confirmed nor denied that he's done that, but in an extra bit of weirdness from Reuters, apparently Trump's already been nominated for the Nobel Prize by two Norwegian lawmakers for the positive developments that he's had on the Korean Peninsula. So he might be in standing no matter what Abe's done.
The mind boggles. Henry Reece Sheridan, thank you for joining us on the line from New York. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves from Giuseppe Verdi's opera Nabucco, a piece of music which was taken on as the anthem of the unification movement. 50 years later, tens of thousands of people lined the streets of Rome for the memorial of Giuseppe Verdi, and not long after, Puccini became the most commercially successful opera composer of all time, worth the equivalent of an estimated $200 million. So, less than 100 years ago, Italy could count music as one of its greatest weapons of soft power. Now, though, I'm not quite sure. È bello essere il primo, bello andare lontano. Stamattina col sole era bella anche Milano. E tu che abbassi gli occhi quando dico che sei sempre più bella. And that, if you didn't have it on constant repeat on whatever method you listen to your music, was by the chart topper Coez. It was called È sempre bello. Italy has arguably got a way to go then to re-establish itself in the world of musical glory. So now a change has been proposed to make sure a healthy quota of Italian songs are aired on the radio. 30%, no less. It's intended to install a fresh sense of pride in the country's music. Well, I'm joined on the line by Liv Siddall, who's a writer and cultural broadcaster. Liv, a very warm welcome to Monocle 24. What's gone wrong with Italian music?
Good question. I actually quite enjoyed that Coez song, not going to lie. it's quite fun. Gone wrong, I don't think is the right word, but I don't think Italy's ever been
Its biggest export has never been music, even though they've had some fantastic operas and great musical output. It's never been something they've been really known for. So maybe it's not really gone wrong, but it seems to me that perhaps it's the infrastructure in the music industry in Italy that maybe could be something of an issue here rather than the music itself. I mean, perhaps there isn't much investment going on in terms of like labels and records and artists, that kind of thing. That would suggest to me maybe why the export hasn't been as big as it could have been.
So there is now this plan to make Italians listen to more Italian music, to make them feel what, more Italian, or to make better music?
I don't know. I suppose it seems to make people more proud of Italian music, which is not a bad thing. I think that's great. I mean, people should be proud of the music that their country makes, and there's nothing wrong with the Italian music in the charts at the moment. I've had a listen to it, and it's great, and actually there's a lot of it. Their charts kind of do mirror the UK's a lot in terms of Ariana Grande and other artists, and there's artists from Puerto Rico, there's American artists, but there's loads of Italian stuff in there. I feel like Italians seem to be enjoying their music, so this new law or new supposed law would actually be, I mean, maybe a bit odd, because it seems like it's already going quite well.
So is there any sniff of politics involved in this then?
Potentially. I think it's nice that I think it's pleasing that an MP can take an interest in cultural stuff. So and puts forward proposals to kind of make culture better. But I do admit that it's maybe a little bit, it makes my skin crawl a bit, the idea that creative output can be sort of controlled in that way. And I don't really like the idea of that. I love the idea of Italians wanting more Italian music on the radio, but the idea that there would be rules in place, such as it has to be 30% more and it has to be this kind of rule, that makes me feel a bit odd, because I think radio has for so long been such a kind of free, fantastic medium that obviously it's sort of built around playlists, but there's so much freedom to it and so much wonderful kind of, I don't know, so much to explore in radio, that to kind of put limitations on it is a bit worrying for me.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because the only experience I've ever had was living in France when the law switched that made everybody, I think it was half of what was on the radio, be French. And we went overnight from some really, really, really bad soft 80s rock to some pretty bad French music, I'll have to give you that. But within 2 years, we had Air, we had Daft Punk, and before you know it, France had suddenly found its place somewhere where it could play its own music and grow.
Yes, that's true. I did read about that in France, and there was some kind of boycott thing which made them low, because it was 40%, I think. So maybe it does work. And you're right, if it gave the world Daft Punk, then so be it. But I do think if people are going to start trying to put these laws in, I think they should sort of maybe take a step back and look at maybe the music community, the music industry in the whole country. Maybe look at record stores, look at community areas, look at supporting young musicians or young labels, and kind of start from the ground up, because only when you have support for those things is that when you kind of breed fantastic musicians and great communities and music lovers and, you know, small venues, that's support for that kind of thing. I think that's a good place if they really want to start making all this good stuff. I mean, maybe that would be a good place to start, really.
Finally, Liv, imagine this. You've suddenly become an Italian cultural ambassador in 10 seconds or less. What song should we now go and hunt out that we should immediately listen to that will make us all fall in love with Italian music?
Oh, that is such a good question. I don't know. I mean, I've been having a good time today on the Shazam charts. I don't know if anyone else goes on those at all, but you can go on the Shazam charts for any country in the world and just peruse what everyone's been Shazamming. So I would just have a look at that. I mean, you can look at any country, but just peruse the Italian charts, because actually this is something that I've never done until today, and I've been pleasantly surprised.
Well, it's where we found Coez's E Sempre Bello, so we'll play that another day for you.
Yeah.
Liv Seddal, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. That's all we have time for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our producer, Augusta Macellari and Ben Rylan, researchers Daphne Karnesis and Helena Jarit, and our studio manager, Christy Evans. The Globalist is here in 8 hours time. Georgina Godwin is your host for that. And the Monocle Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.